Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring Philip Beverly from Chicago State University, Democrat Michael Carbonaggi, Republican Stephanie Hitt, and Republican Josh Cantrell. Our program tonight coming to you from our own base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. Of course, you can join us also live on our website, beyondthebeltway.com, and if you miss it on a Sunday night, you can find it there forever. But, of course, we are also live on Facebook at Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont, and also live around the world on YouTube. So, again, it's nice to have you with us. Happy St. Patrick's Day. We're in Chicago. Everybody is in the spirit, or at least none of our guests are in the spirit of this, other than myself.
I'm trying.
I was amazed that the Sunday morning shows, not one of the moderators wore a green tie or anything. So I decided I'm going to outdo them with a green sweater tonight. So nice to have you with us. For those listening to us on radio, yes, indeed, I am wearing a green sweater. It's been a tragic week with this outburst of violence in New Zealand, 50 dead as a result of the crazed actions of a 28-year-old gunman. We're going to talk about it. We're not naming his name, but we're going to be talking a great deal about it this evening. The President of the United States was asked to respond to it earlier in the week, and obviously that response has created somewhat of a controversy because some people felt he did not go far enough. But here's the question, and here is the President's response.
Speaking of words, here's the president being asked about the issue of white supremacy and the mass murder in New Zealand.
You see today white nationalists rising threat around the world.
I don't really. I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems. I guess if you look at what happened in New Zealand, perhaps that's a case.
But Philip Beverly, do you think it's a small group of people around the world? You're a Democrat, but obviously every action that they take, or most actions that they take, lives are lost. There is violence. There is media coverage. But how widespread is it?
I don't know that the actual perpetrators of the violence are that large a group. What I'm more concerned about is enablers who may just wring their hands and not want to acknowledge or say, oh, well, they're just extremist, and if we ignore them, they'll go away. I think it has to be confronted and confronted directly. When the Department of Homeland Security cut funding to combat white nationalist and white extremism last year in 2017, that was a little problematic for me because I thought, okay, are we not getting some clues here? And I think that, you know, the incidents that we've had here, the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, speaks to that.
Josh Cantrell, what is your reaction to this? You're one of our card-carrying conservatives tonight.
It's a horrible tragedy. And whatever needs to be done to confront it should be done.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm thinking about social media sites and the ability of somebody sitting in their basement to spread violence. That's a problem, and I don't think there's enough of a discussion about what we do about that. And we're talking about extremism. There's extremism on the left. There's extremism on the right. And we as a society, whether it's the governments, but also these tech companies, need to figure out a way to – we're not going to stop it, but at least mitigate it.
Michael Carbonaggi is one of our Democrats tonight. Michael, nice to have you with us.
Great being here.
Your reaction to the question, I mean, how widespread do you think this is?
I think it's starting to build upon itself. The fact that these shooters and the New Zealand shooting had painted the names of other white supremacists who had also committed murder and attacks. They had the names of Dylan Roof from the Charleston shooting. They had the names of the Synagogue of Life shooters from Pittsburgh. They had the names of the Sikh temple shooters in Wisconsin. It feeds upon itself, and they listen to each other. Josh's point is absolutely correct. What used to be in these dark corners of the internet now gets brought out in the daylight, and when the president and others qualify and say perhaps maybe small minimizing, we need to attack it head on.
Do you think he minimalized it in his response?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the statistics show off from the Department of Justice and from state AGs. 75% of these attacks come from white nationalists. They don't come from radical Islam or ISIS in this country. And that's another point, too, we've got to talk about, which is, are we using our resources to fight this in the right way?
Stephanie Hitt, or other Republican, your reaction?
Well, you know, this is the cynic in me, and that is that I think our president has very clearly denounced this kind of violence and these kind of things. The problem is that we have a media that wants him to react in a different way, maybe in a more emotional or more strident or more angry, more... there's something that the media is expecting him to respond in a way that is not national.
They felt
this way after Charlottesville as well.
They want him to denounce in a very strong way, because it is their perception that within the Trump coalition, there's a strain of people who are extreme, and they would not have voted for Donald Trump. And the fear is that if Donald Trump were to come out and really lambast them, that maybe they will go another way.
But is that realistic? Yeah, but he has. He has denounced them.
I mean, nothing
not to
that
many
he
people's
says.
Liking, though.
But not to the media.
In Charlottesville, he said there were very fine people on both sides. I got to tell you, if you're a Nazi, can't really be very fine people there.
But Phil, there's just something.
When did it become okay after World War II, for example, to be a Nazi and just be like, oh yeah, that's cool in the United States?
But he wasn't referring to Nazis. I agree with you, Phil. Yeah. It's not cool to be a Nazi. I'm Jewish, so I'm completely in agreement with you there. But what the president was saying was that there were fine people on both sides. He was talking about the people who didn't want the statues taken down.
Right.
Okay.
But that's not what he said.
That's not
what the media would let him say. Let's be honest.
Donald Trump has no problem communicating for himself via Twitter.
Directly. Absolutely.
And I would say also, Bruce, remember what he did. The president did offer his words of condolences to the New Zealand Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. In response, she asked him to say nicer and better things more often about Muslims in America. Mm-hmm. I think today would be great if he didn't play golf at Mar-a-Lago, if he'd been in a mosque. If he would go with the Muslim community today and share in their sorrow. We had a large number of rallies today here, memorial ceremonies here in Chicago. It would be great if he would find a mosque to go to in Virginia. I think that would send the right message. And hopefully, as people are telling him that these optics matter.
Well, I think going to a mosque would be a great idea, but I can imagine him being criticized for that. This is political opportunism or something like that. But I agree with you. I'd love to see him go to a mosque like my wife did last night.
1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. We'll continue with your response when we roll on from Chicago.
Standing up for what's right, helping out when things go wrong, seeking the truth and speaking our minds, not just making records, but breaking them. Leading the way behind the camera, beyond the runway, and on the silver screen. Not just making our mark, but making a difference. Now that's a job for a Girl Scout. Girl Scouts, preparing girls for a lifetime of leadership.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Mr. parking lot back in Chicago. We're continuing our discussion. I want to kind of zero in on the internet and how we treat people who have strong political beliefs. Because the last 3 or 4 weeks in this program, we've been talking about Semitism, either real or perceived, by members of Congress. That's been something that's been near and dear to your heart, talking about denouncing it, Josh. But there are people who are listening to this program this evening who live in the United States of America. They believe in freedom, but they may not like Jews. They may not like black people. They may not like Muslims. Do they have a right to their beliefs, Josh?
They have a right to not like other groups. I mean, these are not people I would want to associate with or be friends with. I consider.
Or would they want to associate with you?
Right, right. That's absolutely true. But they have a right to their beliefs, and we have something in this country called the First Amendment. But the critical part is that they can't act on their beliefs. They can't act on their beliefs in a way that foments violence.
That's
the problem.
That's the real challenge.
Well,
absolutely. I am, as you know, a First Amendment guy, been involved in a federal lawsuit around First Amendment rights. And believe what you will, and know you don't get to incite violence. You don't get to walk into a synagogue and kill 12 people. You don't get to walk into a mosque and kill 50 people.
That's true.
And
but
say,
back to my question.
It's just my beliefs.
If there are people in the country who don't like black people, how far can their rights go?
For them to say whatever they want to say.
Yeah.
Well, they have the
in a
right,
public
they,
in a public place.
They have the right to speech. They have the right to assembly. They have the right to publish and promote what they want. But the problem you get is Charlottesville. The far left and the far right both showed up on the same street to yell at each other at the top of their lungs. And if you're a police officer on the side, you know that you're in the middle of a tinderbox.
They have a right to assemble.
Correct.
Yes, absolutely.
Or march. I mean,
peacefully. Do they have a right? Yeah.
Peacefully. Pardon me. Peacefully.
Do they have a right to assemble on the internet? Stephanie.
As of now, yes, they do. That is one of the
freest. What do you personally think about that? What do you personally think about providing a platform?
Well, there's a difference between providing a platform and I personally would not want to. I think that there's a marketplace that will determine whether they want to be providers for those hate-filled platforms. But we all know that you go down a very dangerous, very slippery slope when we start editing content of words. And, you know, I often explain this to my children is one of the things, and I think a lot of millennials today, for example, forget that what was one of the biggest things was Nazis wanted to march in Skokie. That was huge. That was one of the seminal First Amendment occasions in this country. And, you know, we allowed that because what was clear was we allow freedom of speech, ideas, whatever, assembly, because we believe in the goodness of men and women to understand good ideas versus bad ideas. And we cannot... We're not allowed to censor those. And so what's important is let the hatred be seen for what it is. And actually, in that moment, as hateful as it is to have Nazis marching in Skokie, much good came out of that. For example, there's a wonderful Holocaust museum that was built, born completely out of that.
But if you are providing space for them to deliver on what they believe is their free speech right,
you can do that.
There's a possibility that there is not someone there that is challenging them on what they have to say. And what you have is a group of followers or friends that friend you on Facebook.
We have that now.
And we have that now.
Yes, we do.
And a lot of Facebook, whether it has nothing to do with controversial stuff, people who are friends of people on Facebook tend to agree with what that person has to say.
Right.
So my question is, if someone, you know, hates blacks or hates Jews, and they go out there and they start spewing it, does that person need to be shut down by anybody? You're a free speech guy, Bill.
No, you can't. You can't. So you can't shut that down.
What? Can, all right. Can you soften it in some way? How do you soften it?
Are you talking about soften the producer or the reader? The
both.
Producer of the content?
Both.
Well, we were talking before, the producers of the content now, and I'm going to step back. When it comes to the internet, we're in the early days of figuring out how to regulate it. The law always catches up with technology, whether it's print, TV, radio, internet, copyright law, IP law, it's always catching up with the technology. And I think now the fact that the left, the right, Democrats and Republicans are looking at this going, we need to have some sort of discussion of what the law is going to be. I think on the reader, people are very nervous. They're very nervous about saying, I don't want the government stepping in to say what I read. I don't want them taking books off the shelf at the library, and I don't want them letterboxing websites. However, if you're Facebook, you no longer get to say, well, we're just simply an aggregator. We don't have a newsroom. We don't have editors. We don't have reporters. I think those days are evolving into something new. Whether they want to do it on their own or they're told to do it, we'll see.
Well, Facebook has a responsibility. There's no question about it. And Facebook doesn't have enough staff to deal with this because this guy was live streaming for 17 minutes.
Right.
And what about having some sort of delay, perhaps?
Right.
There's got to be more of a discussion about how to regulate.
But the delay in that case might only have delayed police responding to it. He was still doing it. So it's more than, I mean, the concept of a delay sounds pretty good. I mean, they have that on talk radio. But after a while, I mean, 17 minutes on Facebook, you could be talking to, you know, tens of millions of people.
Well, I mean, you can start to, you know, hedge around the edges of that. What is it? You know, I think on the radio, is it generally like a 7-second delay or something like that? You have a minute delay to determine, okay, is this going to be a live rampage or is this just a video clip from a movie? And so there are ways, I think there are ways they can do it in a way that still would enable, you know, police and first responders to do their job. Also, and this is, it's going to go a step further. We're not just talking about the live streaming. We're asking Facebook to start sifting through to see what's right. being posted as they told people they were going to be live streaming. So there is warnings and advance information that we're going to be, people are going to be asking Facebook to look through.
Let's go deeper than that. If you have someone who's out there who the president described, you know, these people are sick. I mean, the point is there are a lot of people in this country and around the world who don't like blacks, don't like Jews, don't like Muslims.
Right.
They fear them. But what gets in their mind, it might be moved by something they've read or seen on Facebook.
Right.
But for the most part, it's something that they have in their head and in their hearts.
Well, that's true.
And how do you get to that?
We're trying to figure that out.
That's evil.
I don't know that you even try to get to that, because it seems as though if you pathologize that behavior, one of the things, or that belief system, you're making people wrong. And You're saying to them that there's something about you that about you as a human being that's unacceptable, and that drives that further and further into the shadows, right? And it's looking for some sort of expression. It needs some expression so that sunlight can disintegrate it, if you will, right? Because it's not going to survive scrutiny.
But they feel shunned because an authority figure has made them feel shunned. Is there something other than an authority figure that can be speaking out on these things? We've talked about religious leaders. I mean, religious leaders try to do it.
Pop culture. Pop culture is unbelievably influential.
And I was going to add, too, I also, you know, to be consistent, we probably should quit saying that some are sick when they commit these violent acts. The idea that there's an illness, I mean,
some are just bigots and racists.
That's right.
And some are just evil.
Let's not give them the excuse.
The New Zealand shooter had a GoPro and a body cam and had, from what all intents and purposes looks like, a pretty well thought out rational plan here. That doesn't show mental illness. Dylan Roof, who shot up the Charleston church, he tried a mental illness, and they looked at the planning involved. They're like, that's not a mentally sick mind. No. That's a hate filled mind, and we're not going to use hate as some sort of defense. You're just a common criminal or murderer.
That's right.
But this is a discussion that we've been having in this country Absolutely. Ever since it was founded. And we haven't been able to figure it out. And now we have social media, we have the internet, and all of that, which is just speeding this up. And you're right, the law eventually does catch up with technology, but it's taken a long time here.
Yeah. And also keep in mind when Walter Cronkite called Lee Harvey Oswald just a loser.
Yeah.
He didn't go into the analysis of separated from his wife, alcohol problem, discharged from the Army. Yeah, he just said he was a loser. Let's not spend a lot of time going over the background of what got him here today. And the Warren Commission looked at the other mechanics of how he got the gun and what have you. But
John Wilkes Booth was a loser. Just a lot of these guys are losers.
The media has been doing that. I mean, many, many stations will not use names.
Absolutely.
They will not do anything that will glorify or in any way promote these people.
They're
and they're catching up to that.
That's relatively new. Yeah.
But really, since Columbine,
in this particular case, they're not even showing his face. They're blowing out
the
face.
They don't. They don't want to make these heroes or martyrs.
I mean, his name has been mentioned, but again, based on what he's had to say, he had some things, a reference in this 180-page. I think it was 180 pages.
Yeah.
80 pages.
It's a lot.
It's still too long.
It's a lot.
But
it was this screed against
everything.
Against the world, against everything. And there was one reference in there to Donald Trump. I want to come back and talk about it when we return. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8029, live tonight on St. Patrick's Day from Chicago.
Debt. We can all get in a bit too deep. Members of the NFCC, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, can help you put debt in its place.
Credit cards took charge of my financial life. An NFCC credit counselor helped me get back in control. I took charge of my debt.
Student loan debt followed me wherever I went. My NFCC financial advocate taught me all I needed to know. I mastered my student loan debt.
We wanted to buy our first home, but weren't sure if we were mortgage ready. Our NFCC housing counselor helped us make a plan. We're on a path to our first home.
NFCC member agencies serve all 50 states and Puerto Rico. Convenient, helpful, knowledgeable, nonprofit, financial advocates there for you.
We put debt in its place.
Be one of 5 million people to beat debt by 2020. Connect with an NFCC certified credit counselor at your local member agency today. Go to nfcc.org/stopdebt or call 877-410-6322.
So, back in Chicago with our four guests this evening, and we're going to take a moment and let them introduce themselves. And we are going to be beginning with Mike Carbonacci.
Bruce, thanks. I'm Mike Cabanargi. I'm commissioner with the Cook County Board of Review. Prior to that, I was a senior attorney with the SEC in Chicago, and I used to work for Senator Dick Durbin and Senator Paul Simon.
And in the race for mayor, you are supporting?
Tony Preckwinkle,
who's the president of the Cook County Board. And we go to Stephanie Hitt.
I'm Stephanie Hitt. I'm a Republican activist. I am a reformed attorney. I live in the very, very strong Democratic stronghold of Evanston. So I'm like a lone wolf.
What is a reformed lawyer? What does that
means I no longer practice. And
what
I
did you
I
practice?
Put those,
I
cut my first teeth in the office of Rudy Giuliani at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, Southern District. And then I went into private practice and did employment law before becoming eventually a division attorney for IBM.
Okay.
Stephanie, it sounds like it's an AA meeting when you say that. My name's Stephanie, and I used to be a lawyer. And
well, and I noticed I'm sitting here with some attorneys, and you need some help.
Welcome.
Thanks, Bruce. I'm an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University and have done for a bit more than 27 years. Just enjoying.
And you've been on the show now for well over 10 years.
Well over 10 years.
Yeah. And the ever-popular Josh Cantrow joins us.
Thank you for having me again, Bruce. Josh Cantrow, I'm a Republican and pro-Israel activist and cybersecurity and privacy attorney. And I always love being on this show.
You're a Jewish conservative Republican.
Jewish conservative Republican in Chicago.
So you have a caucus of about three people to get
together. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, you know what? There's actually a lot more, but they're in the closet, so to speak.
so to speak, okay.
Yeah.
I won't touch that. By the way, just a couple of mentions. As you may have read, if you live in the Chicagoland area, the Museum of Broadcast Communications is downsizing. And what that means is that if you have not come down to see Saturday Night Live, The Experience, it's only going to be here for another couple of weeks. March 31st, it closes forever. It is a phenomenal exhibit. If you've not come down to see it, you've got a few weeks later left to do it. And in the course of preparing for what is happening next year, I've had to go through tons and tons of boxes, personal, professional, museum-related history, and it's been a very challenging for those Facebook friends, as I've shared some of my thoughts. It's really quite a... It's quite a stressful experience when you're going through and you're sorting through and you're passing things out, things that are part of your life. But I found a few things that I thought our guests would be interested in. First of all, since we have four political people, I'm going to give you all a Dumont button. Now, this Dumont button was when I ran for the state Senate back in 1970, and there's a blue one and there's a black one, so I'm going to pass these out, two to each side. So you have the, if you save those, by the way, if you save them, they're not likely to be worth too much because I have, even though, are you, you're figuring out which one you want? You want the blue, the black? Okay.
Well, I still have some of your old anniversary buttons.
Well, the anniversary buttons, that's another thing. So I threw about several hundred of them away as well, but these are collector's items. There's just a few. There's just a few hundred left, and that's after throwing hundreds away. And I also found some interesting bumper stickers, and I'm going to give this one to I'm going to give this to Mike Carbonaggi. This says the Czechs registered their guns.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to give that to you. And then to our good friend, Mr. Beverly, I'm going to give this bumper sticker, which says, "Frontier is socialism."
Boom.
And this, by the way, that's based on John F. Kennedy's perception, so you know how long that is. And to Josh Cantrow, I'm going, since he referenced that he is Jewish, I'm going to give him a 1964 Goldwater Miller bumper sticker.
There we go.
In your heart, you knew he was right.
Yes.
And again, I'm going to, this goes back, this is more Illinois politics.
Yeah.
But again, he was governor for 16 years. I'm going to give you a big John Thompson,
big
Thompson for governor.
All right.
Or a bumper, but a bumper sticker. So those are your parting gifts for this evening. And again, we'll see what we have for our guests next week, because we have I have a lot of stuff left and I've only got a few more weeks to get rid of it. By the way, let me mention this. By the way, let me first of all say it's if the the Twitter handle is @Dumo, and this is kind of serious. If you are a political collector of big items, posters, things of that nature, not campaign buttons, because I'm going to keep those. But if you are a collector of other sort of political memorabilia, let me know, because literally I am in the process of getting rid of a lot of stuff that might be important to you. I mean, how many people have a Hiram Fong for president sign? You don't have that many of those around. But do let me know, and again, just drop me a note to @Dumo, and we will be in touch and we'll talk political memorabilia. Anyway, back to our discussion. I want to just finish up on what we can do, if anything, or what the next step should be, because there's been some references here as to what the major tech companies should be doing. Is this a bipartisan thing? Do Republicans and Democrats, Josh, do you feel this is important too?
I do. I think it probably is a bipartisan thing, sort of like the recent crime bill that was signed was bipartisan, and I would hope that this would be as well.
Right.
I want to get back to an issue that is near and dear to your heart, and that is anti-Semitism, because we're talking about anti-Semitism or the experience of anti-Muslimism or white supremacy that came out of the story in New Zealand. Do you believe that is on the rise? And if so, why?
I do believe it's on the rise. The statistics show that it's on the rise. And why it's on the rise, I don't know, but it's coming like it usually does from the right and from the left. And it's a real problem. And I think that what we were talking about in the last segment, social media, has something to do with it. It spreads the virus easier It's quicker. But I don't know exactly why it's happening, but it concerns me that we have members of Congress who, you know, have been condemned as anti-Semites.
Do you believe, when you look at the comments of the representative from Minnesota, and you look at her comments, do you believe that those comments are anti-Semitic, all the comments that she made, that they're anti-Semitic?
Yes, I do, because she is using anti-Semitic tropes to assert dual loyalty against Jews. She is saying things that have always been used against Jews and saying that Jews cannot be loyal to the United States and Israel. And quite frankly, this has been going on for some time. The defense of her has been offered that, well, she's a Somali immigrant and we have to give her a break. She's not from this culture. She's actually been here for 20 plus years. And there was a very disheartening article run by the Minneapolis Star Tribune interviewing some of her progressive, Jewish progressive backers who came out of meetings with her when she was a state representative trying to educate her on anti-Semitism, and you can't say these things, and she just didn't get it.
Do you think they're anti-Semitic, Phil?
There are some statements that are anti-Semitic, and I think it becomes important for us to distinguish what is a legitimate criticism of Israel and its politics, and what is anti-Semitic. And I think sometimes it gets conflated, which for me makes us have to think much more critically about what's being said and take a breath and go, no, wait a second, is that or isn't it, before just sort of blurting out things, especially the tropes that Josh talks about. It's like, really? You didn't know that? No, we don't know. That's one, but it's not true, but two, it just perpetuates the problem.
One of her concerns is when she talked about the Benjamins. She was repeating something which a lot of people have felt or been stated for a long time, and that is the power of AIPAC, the Jewish lobby, that a lot of money goes in that, and they spread their money out to members of Congress, and they support Israel. And she's raising the question, does it, along with the money that's been given out to members of Congress, do they get a free pass on supporting Israel?
Well, you know, I think we have to roll it back a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, her comments, her comments and what she's most criticized for are things that aren't really have to do with Israel, but they have to do that are, it's the comments that are purely anti-Semitic. But, you know, stepping aside a little bit, we're looking at, and this is where we turn this political now. We're looking at a party, the Democratic Party, which has had a really hard time. You know, all these comments about Donald Trump doesn't say enough against, you know, these crazy right-wing nuts and so on. Okay, those kinds of criticism is also against the Democrats. I mean, we're looking at a party that allowed Louis Farrakhan's comments, which are clearly anti-Semitic, to be brushed under the rug. And now we've got a full-blown member of Congress who is somehow being excused, or, you know, nobody's denouncing her with the same fervor that they're asking Donald Trump to do. So what I find is the interesting double standard, but we're also looking at a history of a party that has not been significantly pro-Israel and now has an anti-Semitic problem.
I think Mike Carbonacci has a comment on that.
Yeah, I would just say welcome to the party. I mean, we've for 20 years, we've had to watch Steve King of Iowa say some of the most hateful, prejudicial statements. And I don't know what line he crossed, but thank God the Republican Party realized he had crossed a line. What the congressman from Minnesota said was completely wrong. The dual loyalty trope, as a Catholic, we've been hearing since John F. Kennedy was running for president, he was going to take his marching orders from the Pope. That is a prejudicial, hate-filled line that we've used. Now, unfortunately, it's a dog whistle that's come out with the Internet is more than a dog whistle.
When we come back, we'll talk more. 1-800-723-8029. Before we leave you tonight, we'll be talking about John McCain and Donald Trump.
It's a bully, but we aren't afraid of a fight. It's elusive, but our focus never fades. It's deadly, but we were born to defeat cancer. You may not have heard of us, but our work has helped millions impacted by cancer. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. We are leaders in advancing breakthroughs in immunotherapy, genomics, and personalized medicine. This research saves lives. After 65 years of fighting blood cancers, we've arrived at a game-changing belief. The cures for cancer are in our blood. The drugs and treatments we've developed for blood cancers have helped people affected by many different types of cancers. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Beating cancer is in our blood. Learn more at LLS.org.
Bruce Dumont back on the air. Let's go to George listening to us in El Paso on KTSM. Go ahead, George.
First, I want to say happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. I hope there isn't any presidential candidate out there who is wearing the green. But the reason I called was because I think that the remarks that have been made from Minnesota with regards to the congresswoman,
yes,
that she needs to be broadly conscientious of the fact that Israel, it actually seems to have a chair of thought in the United States House of Representatives, where she sits, if not in the Senate, and that she needs to think that just as her interests are residing in the House with regards to her election, that those also reside in the House with regards to those who are elected by those interests. And she has no reason to complain about how those interests get into the House, just as no one has any reason to complain about the way her interests have got into the House either.
Yeah, well, I agree with the point, but I would say that Israel is very broadly supported in America, and I think that a lot of time AIPAC's role is overstated. AIPAC doesn't contribute at all to congressional campaigns. It can't by law. It's more of an educational arm. They do a great job of taking Congress members over to Israel and educating them there and on the issues here. So that's one point I would
make. Thanks very much for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
What about those that would argue is that she is a representative of the people, of her people? I would cut that line off. That she's a representative of her people, and back in her district, she may be representing the positions of those people that sent her to Washington.
And so there's two ways to represent. One is exactly that mm-hmm. you just represent and become a mouthpiece for constituents. The right. other that is obviously more difficult is that you take a more principled position against your constituents, but the right position. And so she had the opportunity to be more principled and didn't. So if you want to say, yes, she's just representing those voices in her district, okay, that's fine. And could she have done that differently? And I would say that she could have done that differently.
Yeah, and that's, to Phil's point exactly, she needed to take the opportunity, if that was the case, to lead her own constituents, to not follow their worst instincts, perhaps, but to lead them. Mm-hmm.
Is this issue going to be one that's going to stick around and become part of the 2020 campaign, Mike? In other words, candidates representing yes. the Democratic Party are going to have to respond to questions about her or other things that may flare up between now and Election Day, either that she says or that AOC says that they're going to be put on the defensive.
I think this country is going to be dealing, because of New Zealand and because of the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh and because of the Sikh attack in Wisconsin and Steve King's comments and her comments, we're going to be having a large discussion that, again, is a bipartisan problem we got to deal with, is, you know, how do we rise above our baser instincts and lead this country?
The reason why the extremes exist is they feel that they have been wronged by someone. Mm-hmm. There may be hatred in their heart that may have started at childhood, but they feel that they've been wronged by someone. Is there anything that society can do or media can do to basically explain to those who feel like they've been left out by society, to give them a hearing or to give them some sense that at least they've been listened to in a meaningful way, so that it doesn't become a rallying point for similar hatred by those that follow them on the Internet.
I think that's a great point, and that gets back to our use of resources at DOJ and Homeland Security and otherwise. After 9/11, they did a lot of work of identifying the profile of someone who would become a terrorist. We need to take a look at somebody who takes their ideas again in a chat room online. I don't know if people even use the phrase chat rooms, conversation online, and how that gets to a shooting, how that gets to action. And again, you know, these tech companies need to be a partner on that. I mean, this is their business, and I think law enforcement needs to work with them to your point, identify the characteristics of somebody who starts that way. They're a victim, and they're looking for other people who are victims and how that gets put into.
So we're talking about the Internet, and that's great, and we've had a good discussion on that. But what about the schools? I think the schools have a role to play here. We've got to reinforce American values in schools. And one of the things that's a big American value is that we are open, that we're welcoming, that we are that we have lots of different ethnic and religious groups in this country, and that's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And so I just wonder if the public schools and private schools are doing enough on this issue.
But don't you think there's a real challenge there that, yes, that sounds good, but then it bumps up against parents who say, well, I don't want you teaching that to my kid. I should tell them about those issues. Just like with responsible sex education. No, you don't tell them about that. I'll tell them about that. And so then what happens when a vocal minority in a particular district decides that they're going to protest any attempts at diversity, inclusion, that kind of deal.
You raise a great point. I'm sounding like the liberal here, and you're giving the conservative pushback. That's a good point. Things should start in the home. The reality is that's not happening enough in America. So I think we have to bring it to the classroom. Holocaust survivors in the classroom have been a big success.
Yeah. Right.
When we come back, we have another full hour. Our thanks to our guests in hour number one. They were so good, they're going to be back by popular demand in just a few moments. 1-800-723 is the phone number. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you for joining us for hour number one of Beyond the Beltway, the after news. For those listening to us on America's great talk radio stations, we will be back with another full hour. And in the next hour, we're going to be talking about an expert in online propaganda. He's going to be looking into ways in which the issue that we've been discussing this evening, how that is being dealt with at the very highest levels of government and throughout the world. You'll want to stay tuned for that. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Standing up for what's right, helping out when things go wrong, seeking the truth and speaking our minds, not just making records, but breaking them. Leading the way behind the camera, beyond the runway, and on the silver screen. Not just making our mark, but making a difference. Now that's a job for a Girl Scout. Girl Scouts, preparing girls for a lifetime of leadership.
It's a bully, but we aren't afraid of a fight. It's elusive, but our focus never fades. It's deadly, but we were born to defeat cancer. You may not have heard of us, but our work has helped millions impacted by cancer. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. We are leaders in advancing breakthroughs in immunotherapy, genomics, and personalized medicine. This research saves lives. After 65 years of fighting blood cancers, we've arrived at a game-changing belief. The cures for cancer are in our blood. The drugs and treatments we've developed for blood cancers have helped people affected by many different types of cancers. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Beating cancer is in our blood. Learn more at lls.org.
Debt. We can all get in a bit too deep. Members of the NFCC, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, can help you put debt in its place.
Credit cards took charge of my financial life. An NFCC credit counselor helped me get back in control. I took charge of my debt.
Student loan debt followed me wherever I went. My NFCC financial advocate taught me all I needed to know. I mastered my student loan debt.
We wanted to buy our first home, but weren't sure if we were mortgage ready. Our NFCC housing counselor helped us make a plan. We're on a path to our first home.
NFCC member agencies serve all 50 states and Puerto Rico. Convenient, helpful, knowledgeable, nonprofit. Financial advocates there for you.
We put debt in its place.
Be one of 5 million people to beat debt by 2020. Connect with an NFCC certified credit counselor at your local member agency today. Go to nfcc.org/stopdebt or call 877-410-6322.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. Roseanne Polito, who's a regular or frequent guest on this program, she sent us a note reminding everybody that Nigerian Muslims killed 120 Christians over a three-week period, and it doesn't seem to get the media support that what happened in New Zealand, that's below the media radar. Speaking of the media radar, let's talk about one of the media's favorite guys, the late John McCain. And President tweeted about John McCain because the Steele dossier got into the hands of one of John McCain's key aides. He shared that information with John McCain, who took allegedly 30 pages of it and sent it over to the FBI. This was in 2016. And the friend of Mr. McCain's also then sent it to BuzzFeed. And although the mainstream media refused to carry the story because it involved so many salacious things about Donald Trump in this dossier, which had been corroborated by no one and hasn't been corroborated by many since, it was revealed last week that Senator McCain and his former aide were in receipt of something that was passed on to the FBI, put into the mainstream media, talking about the salacious aspects of Donald Trump, all unverified, and Donald Trump didn't like it, as you can imagine, and he erupted and challenged John McCain, talking about things that he had done against him by releasing this. He thought it was disgraceful conduct by Senator McCain, and it brought up the whole subject of Donald Trump's opinion of John McCain, who was held in very high esteem by a lot of people because of his 5 years as a war hero, being a POW, and it goes back to things that was said by Donald Trump during the campaign about Senator McCain. So that started a battle, a vendetta, if you will, by Senator McCain. And I want to ask our two Republicans here. John McCain was once at the highest pinnacle of American politics, I think, right, in some respect, insofar as respect is concerned, yeah, even though he was rejected by the voters, yes, when he ran against, yeah, Barack Obama. Josh, what do you think of Senator John McCain now, based on what was revealed last week?
I think John McCain served his country admirably as a war hero and as a senator, but I don't like that he did this. I think that it's problematic and troubling.
Right.
And it feeds into the narrative that mainstream Republicans are against Trump, and,
Well, they are, aren't they?
And I think they are. And I think this just is more proof to Trump's supporters that to his hardcore supporters that the deck is stacked against them.
Right. I was a McCain delegate. So back then I think there was certainly before the general election, there was a lot of great pride out there for John McCain. I mean, he came from behind to win the nomination, and you know, his status as a war hero, as someone who had, but he came with some baggage.
I know, but is there any doubt in your mind that the reason that John McCain did everything that he did against Donald Trump, including voting against the repeal of Obamacare, was because Donald Trump said very bad things about him in his run for the White House.
I think that, sad to say, John McCain made it all personal. And it was a personal vendetta. It was a personal thing. And that is unlikable in politics when you make it that
way. Phil Beverly, can you look at this objectively?
Yeah, I guess the question that I ask is, so what happens if he doesn't turn over the pages from the Steele dossier to the FBI in terms of his own sort of legacy? And it comes out that if the worst thing happens in the end with Donald Trump, and you come to find out that, yeah, he had this information and he didn't share it with the FBI, what does that look like?
Well, it was uncorroborated. I mean, so
it's not McCain's job to corroborate it, which is why you turn it over to the people.
But sharing with the FBI is different than leaking it to BuzzFeed.
Was it the responsibility of his aide, an associate, I should say, wasn't a coat hangler, was it responsible for him to take that information and give it to BuzzFeed with all of the salacious information included in it?
That was unnecessary.
Because that information, it eventually got picked up by the mainstream media. They had denied it. They wouldn't carry it because it was unverified. They ultimately decided to carry it because BuzzFeed carried it. And what was in there, the most salacious aspects of that have never, ever been proven. They were used by late night comics. They were used in a derogatory speech, defamatory skit on Saturday Night Live. They took that lock, stock, and barrel as a bona fide fact, and that has led to where we are today, including the stuff that ultimately went to the FBI to be investigated by James Comey before he was fired by Donald Trump.
And we still don't know if it's been corroborated or not.
Because we know it might have been corroborated,
and you don't know, Stephanie. You don't know. This is an ongoing investigation. It may have been corroborated and not been revealed yet.
There's a rule of thumb in media is that certain political leaders get good press because they help out members of the media. John McCain was one of the most popular people in recent years amongst the Washington Press Corps. That's why he was on Meet the Press or on one of the Sunday shows virtually every other Sunday for almost 5 years. He was the darling. And I've got to tell you, anyone that's on the air that much is probably feeding dirt to other members of the media that may have embarrassed Republicans. Let me finish. And the idea of getting some dirt, it's like a 16-year-old gossip. They got dirt, and he couldn't wait to get it out. Now, again, he took the high road and said, well, I'm going to share it with the FBI. And his aide sent it to BuzzFeed, which started the whole controversy about the Steele dossier, which was created and paid for by Hillary Clinton's campaign. Now, am I the only one at this table that is outraged by that? Mike, are you outraged at all? You're a Democrat.
I can't get into what... I mean, John Cain's not here to explain himself or defend himself, and his aide's act of giving it to the press. I will say that John McCain, in particular, seems to have gotten under Donald Trump's skin more than most people. And I think that the fact that this had
vice versa.
Well, I was going to say,
but and vice versa, and I do know that if not know, but I just suspect that if John McCain did this, he was doing it because he thought it was best for his party, and maybe
no,
best
he
for
thought
his
it was
country.
Best what was for John McCain. And yes. Sadly, and here's the thing, he thought he was the media darling until he actually ran for president, and then he realized. He wasn't the media darling.
Right.
And what they did to him and Sarah Palin is beyond reproachable. And yet he still kept going back to them. He wanted their approval for so long. And I think what we saw at the end, unfortunately, was his bitterness made him not just a thorn in Donald Trump's side. And he only did it because he was against Donald Trump. It wasn't for the good.
But the media loved him and loves him.
They loved him, yeah.
Standing up for what's right. Helping out when things go wrong, seeking the truth, and speaking our minds. Not just making records, but breaking them. Leading the way behind the camera, beyond the runway, and on the silver screen. Not just making our mark, but making a difference. Now that's a job for a Girl Scout. Girl Scouts, preparing girls for a lifetime of leadership.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and again, one issue that we've not touched, and really I think it really is a big political issue. I want to get everybody's reaction, and that is the college admissions scandal.
Yes.
It's something that everybody is talking about, whether you're Republican, Democrat, young, old. You've got an opinion on this.
Yeah.
Let's start with you, Stephanie.
I have an incredibly strong opinion because I'm in the throes of it. I have two in college, one about to go to college, one about to apply to college, and one.
Did you make any donations to anybody?
Yeah, no kidding. Did you
hire a fixer? I did this wrong. I will say this, and this is everybody I know is talking about this, and I can't even go to the grocery store without it. And that is, I think we all have accepted to some degree that there are at elite colleges, and not even so elite, but at colleges around the world, there are kids that get in as legacies or children of celebrities, renowned, because these colleges are businesses. They understand that there's a flow of money they need to have, and by rewarding families who have been legacies or whatever, or bringing in wealth, there is an understanding and a general acceptance that that is part of the business of running a college. That if you have a kid that comes in that maybe isn't quite as qualified, what that kid is bringing in is maybe the family's financial support. What we see in those instances are scholarships, building renovations, sports teams supported, things like that. Things that people actually benefit from in the college community. What I think is blowing most people's minds on this is that this was for nothing but personal, pure gain. This money went right into the pockets of coaches. And I think this really, we all feel like there's a game out there, cards are stacked, it's a kind of a crapshoot, but it goes to the fact that
there's no crapshoot.
So undermined in a way that violates, actual cheating in tests.
Phil, you work at a college. What's your take?
I'm not appalled, and I'm appalled. And the thing that strikes me most about this is that the children of elites, and these are elites, the ones who least need access to elite universities, because you go to elite universities not necessarily for the education, but for the social and professional networks that you're going to build, they don't need those networks. There are black and brown children who can change their family's trajectory for generations who now are going to be denied those opportunities because of this. And that's what's so galling to me.
White students.
Right.
And poor white students who can change the trajectory of their family from rural areas, from urban areas.
Mike, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I've got two kids, 12 and 14. Just like Philip said, it is a zero-sum game. Every seat that's taken by somebody who cheats their way in is a seat that went out to somebody who stayed in on the weekends to study, prep for the SAT, put their nose to the grindstone. And I just think about all these kids who are waitlisted at USC. What are they thinking about right now? I mean, what is their
message?
And what does this say about our society?
Right.
This reveals a sickness in our society at the very highest echelons, and it encourages more cheating, because if people think the game is rigged against them, they're going
to
cheat.
They have
as
to
well.
Adapt
well,
to cheat
and,
themselves.
But Philip touched on something very interesting, and that is, he mentioned that college is a source of social connection, social networking, sort of that step up, which is very interesting, because when we're talking about merit, what we're talking about are people going to college to seek an education. And maybe, you know, we're changing what we think colleges are there for. But at the end of the day, if a college is there to educate your child, to teach them to think better, think critically, to parse through, learn history, all those things that education is for, then yes, there's that meritocracy, and that's the argument. But now we're now saying college is something different than that.
But it's been something different,
really,
Stephanie. That's the
scary
problem.
It's troubling.
But it has been.
It's a job factory. It's what job
it's
do
a
I get
social network
as,
factory.
As the at some places it's that, not at every place.
Right. Yes.
Do you get what I'm saying?
Right.
At this moment in time, you have colleges and admission people and the elite up here, and you have an enraged media and an enraged populace on this.
Oh, yes.
Below the elite level. And my question to you, as a political experience, does this in 2020, Josh Cantrell, is this an issue that President Trump can use? Because anti-elitism was one of the major tenets of his success in 2016. Is this another opportunity for him, especially when you're talking about a U.S. attorney from Massachusetts going after elite Hollywood stars not known for their affection for the president? Is this a perfect opportunity for him to take this issue and do something with and have come up with corrective action and being seen as the champion of those who were run over by the elites?
It's a great issue for him. It's a perfect issue.
It's a great issue for anybody other than Donald Trump.
Other than Donald Trump. Mr. Billionaire?
Bootstraps.
Unless he gets rid of Jared Kushner as his son-in-law, who went to Harvard because his old man gave $2.5 million to Harvard.
The question, come on. The question was to me.
Donald Trump cannot take us to the shack in Louisiana and show that's where I pulled my
mic off. I think I've brought up an issue for 2020.
But it's a great issue for a populist, okay?
Right.
And the
Bernie
the
Sanders.
Point is, the, but the yeah. point is yeah. that all you say is true. He grew up rich and all that, but he won on an anti-elite message.
That's the point.
Which 4 years and, later may not be
and
replicable.
Let's not forget this. This is something really important, and that is one thing that he has on his anti-elitist message is he has hit a strong nerve with people who are hardworking, who roll up their sleeves. I mean, he really did get the blue-collar vote. And so what we're talking about is he can relate to, and this is how he can counter many of these Democratic hopefuls, and we can get into that later, is that what we're saying is you can get into college on a veneer. College is a veneer. It's about how you present yourself. It's your social connections. It's this. And he has basically said, you get to college by hard work. One of the things that people supported Donald Trump was, is he's not a traditional politician. He is a man who actually built something. He's a businessman. Do not forget that element.
But if he says that, hard work, and
doing something and proving success.
I got to let our Democrats talk. Who amongst the Democratic field could best make that case?
I was going to say, there's a number of people, I think, on our side, the Democratic side, who could do it. I will say that let's separate real quick. The folks who did this, that we've seen, these celebrities, they committed a crime. I mean, it's very different than saying, I mean, they literally
allegedly,
purported to have committed a crime. What it's opening the door to, and I think Philip talked about it, is a discussion of the class divide. Because to your point, hard work doesn't get you there. Private tutors does. Private SAT training does. Study abroad programs do. If you have access to resources and money and good school systems, you have a better chance at getting
who can make the anti-elite message real and believable on the Democratic side?
I don't know that
politicians in this era can honestly make that argument, because they're elites by nature of where they're at. These aren't people that necessarily have to work paycheck to paycheck.
Donald Trump has stepped on the elites.
I will say a couple names jump to mind.
You don't believe that? He stepped on the elites to get elected. I think he continues to step on the elites.
And when he hides his grades, his admission, his academic record, that means
he shouldn't have gotten in.
I don't know that it means he shouldn't have gotten in. I think it leads to another question being able to be asked: is he the right guy to say that? Now, does he have a surrogate on the trail who can say that for him? Is Kellyanne Conway the best person to say? Maybe she's the best person to say that. But him getting $450 million purportedly from his old man over the course of his life to start his life? Yeah, I think I'd be doing pretty good if I got $450 million from my old man.
Spitballing it here, I could see someone like Kamala Harris or Cory Booker saying the Department of Education right now should be looking at how do we provide support for low-income students who want to take SAT prep courses, have access to private tutors, really level that playing field so that everybody is apples to apples when you're a college applicant. Betsy DeVos can't really be that person to do that. Donald Trump really can't be that honest spokesperson for that. So those are just some names and some ideas.
I think you're right. I think the two African Americans who are running for president at the moment are the ones most likely to be able to make that case.
And it has to be a real proposal, an idea to fix a problem. Because on our side, we're looking at people who come with proposals and ideas, and not just throwing things out there going,
"But if the president were to create some presidential commission, focus a blue ribbon commission to look at it and let them go out, announce this commission, let them do their work, and then come back with some recommendations that he would follow up on, then that is a way to address the issue. And I think it's an issue that frankly Republicans and Democrats would like to see addressed, because I think this is one of these sort of hot button issues.
But he's got a problem with commissions, because that last one about voter fraud seemed to have gone exactly nowhere. And so I don't have
he's
a lot of trust that he's going to do it
he
the
can
right
do it
way.
With the education
Just making
crisis.
A suggestion. Yeah. May not happen.
And he's probably watching right now. So if you're watching, Mr.
I'm
President, Bruce is available.
All I'm trying
open
to do
for
is
you.
Generate ideas.
For 39 years, I'm just trying to solve issues here every Sunday night.
Bring people together.
When we come back, we'll talk about propaganda on the Internet. Don't go away. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast that we are going to share with you this evening, or share the airwaves, with an expert on information warfare. This is a gentleman that he wrote the seminal paper for NATO on online propaganda, and with all that's going on in the world about propaganda and also the use of the Internet and whether the dark Internet and how devastating it can become to rally at least questionable individuals from around the world, some who are a little bit out there on the violence stage. We're inviting back an old friend of this program, Jeff Giesing. Jeff, nice to have you with us. I've given your brief introduction. We'll talk more about it as the interview flows. You're joining us from Washington, D.C. this evening. But what is your reaction to all of the post-New Zealand controversy about the Internet and maybe the need to govern the Internet to be able to stop shooters from finding like-minded believers around the world? We're not hearing your microphone.
Is he on the speaker?
Keep going. Go ahead. Try it again. We got a little problem with our speaker. Go ahead. No, we are not hearing Jeff. He looks great on Skype, but we are not hearing him.
He can hear us, though.
What we're going to do, Fritz, we'll continue our conversation here, and then if Jeff wants or can join us, just let me know when he can speak, and we will add this to the program. This is live radio and TV. We've not edited this so that this error can be shared. We're sharing it with you live on
no
radio.
Delay.
So let's go back to the subject that, again, we discussed at the beginning of the broadcast, and then when Jeff joins us, we can bring him into the conversation. But this is the serious issue of what can be done to tap down the Internet so we can stop people like the shooter in New Zealand from being able to be to talk with other people and to be inspired by them and perhaps to inspire others.
I guess the cautionary tale I would offer here is from popular culture, and that was Minority Report. We talked earlier about the tech companies having some responsibility here, but I would hate to see that responsibility swing so far into sort of the big data area where it becomes predictive to the point that our rights get infringed upon because we have some percentage probability that violence is going to happen because of this user, and then suddenly the FBI is kicking somebody's door in because they had a bad day. And the tech companies go, well, our algorithms told us, our big data told us that it would predict this. It's a human thing.
Right. Right. And what you're raising is a great point. It's privacy. It's the right to privacy versus the duty that governments have to protect individual citizens. But there's another issue here. We're talking about Facebook. Facebook is in virtually every country in the world, or right, most countries in the world now, maybe not China, maybe a few others. What law governs? What law governs this type of situation here?
Right, whose speech laws, whose First Amendment laws do?
And Josh, you brought up China. I mean, we've seen where it can go when it goes wrong. They've set up a new system that I think is going live later this summer where every citizen will get basically a credit score based upon, you know, where they travel, what books they read, how they use mass transit, how much energy they use at home. It's all going to go into
a credit score.
And
it's
a social, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, Jeff, are you back?
Hey, Jeff.
He's back, yeah.
Are you there?
Yes, hi. Can
okay.
you hear me?
I can now hear you, and we can yeah. hear you, and we can see you.
Welcome, Jeff.
Yes.
Welcome. So here's my question to you. Give me a short take on your reaction to what happened in New Zealand and the international reaction denouncing the use of Facebook Live and other forms of communication this shooter had.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me. It's great to see you, Bruce. I'm getting a little bit of I'm not hearing this as easily, so forgive me if I don't answer perfectly. But obviously, as a grave tragedy, what happened. This was somewhat unique in that it was almost a troll that spilled into real life, where he, you know, this guy was radicalized in 8chan and in darker corners of the internet, and kind of took that into the real world with this almost ironic sensibility and wrote his manifesto. And from a psychological warfare and propaganda standpoint, he really knew what he was doing and thought through it. And in many respects, we've been playing into the playbook that I think he set in motion for us through his manifesto, which is kind of inevitable. So it's been a real mess in the wake of this tragedy. But at the same time, I think there are different people are chipping away at the issue in different ways. And I think there's a lot more of a rapid OODA loop, a learning loop around these types of situations now today than there was two or three years ago. There's also a deeper understanding, I think, of internet culture, mm-hmm. and some of the analyses that I've been reading on that have been much better. And then in terms of shutting down the internet, or how do we, you know, do we not mention his name? Do we not post the video? Do we share the manifesto? I think those issues are really still being ironed out.
Philip Beverly has a question for you. He's a professor at Chicago State.
Hi, Jeff. You mentioned radicalization of this New Zealand offender. Is the radicalization process sort of universal, say, with radical Islamic fundamentalist and white nationalist and along the continuum of people? So there, and I ask the question, so is there a larger sort of way to get all of them, or are they sort of unique?
That's a great question. There is they all have the similar characteristic in that I would call it stochastic terrorism inspired by online propaganda and signifiers. So they're similar in structure and then different in form. So somebody in theory could be radicalized into Islamism and kind of ISIS ideology through online chat rooms and so forth, and then without any instructions from anybody, carry out an act of terrorism. In this case, it's sort of similar where there isn't a coordination or organization, but somebody could get radicalized online and then have that spill out into the real world. And in theory, any foreign adversary, any movement globally could use the same playbook. So this issue isn't just about white nationalism, it's really about the structure of terrorism in the 21st century.
To what extent, when people are communicating online, maybe for a goal of creating some form of violence, okay, so they're communicating with each other. Who is observing, who is watching and reviewing what's going on, and at what point do they say, aha, we have to stop this, or There's something going wrong here that we should act on?
So that is up to the different platforms. So right now we have platforms in different locations around the world. I think a good example of this is Gab. Gab is a site very similar to Twitter, and you may recall the guy who shot 10 or 11 people in the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh posted on Gab just before then. And Gab says that it abides by all U.S. laws. It positions itself as a free speech platform, and it cooperates with all authorities and so forth. And yet it still kind of has all of these other elements of, cesspool language and so forth. So I think it's up to individual platforms to monitor themselves on the one hand, and then there's a legal compliance situation where Gab, for example, being based in America, has to obey U.S. laws and willingly does so. But we're moving towards an era where, conceivably some of these platforms will be beyond the reach of any government and any law enforcement agency. So 8chan, for example, I don't know where that's based exactly. I believe the ownership is in Japan. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. Mm-hmm. So it's really up to the platforms to monitor this stuff. I think governments are getting smarter about managing and monitoring the information environment. But pretty soon we'll move to an era where I think communication will take place in beyond the reach of governments and the law.
Are you worried about what happens next in the wake of New Zealand and the investigations and the conversations that will follow?
What do I think will happen next?
Yeah. What are you worried about it? Are you worried about anything?
Yes. I think I worry about a couple of things. One is I worry about an overreaction to this because I personally am against a lot of the censorship, and I believe strongly in civil discourse and freedom of speech. So I think there's a risk of overreactioning from that standpoint. I think there's a risk of playing into the playbook that the shooter wanted, which is accelerating the civil strife happening across the West, and that kind of dialectic of violence, you could say. And then I also worry about this could become more common with more destructive technology. We haven't seen this with bioweapons, for example. Like, imagine this guy with bioweapons. That's what we need to be thinking about.
When we come back, we're going to pause for some breaks, and then when we come back, we'll let other questions from our guests And I've got a few more for you as well. We're talking to Jeff Giesing. He joins us from Washington, D.C. this evening. He is an expert on online propaganda. Back shortly from Chicago and D.C.
It's a bully, but we aren't afraid of a fight. It's elusive, but our focus never fades. It's deadly, but we were born to defeat cancer. You may not have heard of us, but our work has helped millions impacted by cancer. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. We are leaders in advancing breakthroughs in immunotherapy, genomics, and personalized medicine. This research saves lives. After 65 years of fighting blood cancers, we've arrived at a game-changing belief. The cures for cancer are in our blood. The drugs and treatments we've developed for blood cancers have helped people affected by many different types of cancers. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Beating cancer is in our blood. Learn more at lls.org.
We continue in Chicago with our guests and also Jeff Giza, who joins us from Washington. Jeff, obviously there are many ideologies that are using the Internet to move forward their own beliefs. Is there a similar goal that I would think that some would have would be just general chaos, just, you know, a rage against governments everywhere. Is there any evidence that forces left of center or right of center are having any sort of combination discussions as to how they could join together and really wreak havoc?
Well, I think there's a, you know, foreign adversaries like Russia have entire schools of propaganda based on causing those divisions and accelerating and exacerbating our tensions and accelerating our conflict. China also is increasingly thinking about this stuff. I mean, it's unrestricted warfare mindset. So foreign governments are one potential source of people who want to come in and amplify all of the tension and conflicts in the wake of crisis events. We see a lot of disinformation actors as well emerging in the immediate aftermath of crisis events like a mass shooting. You may recall various disinformation after the Orlando shooting, after the Las Vegas shooting, and other incidents like that. It's a very sensitive period, the immediate time after that. In terms of different political movements, I mean, I think different ideologies naturally want to score points against others, and so there's a risk of events like this being weaponized, for example, to put, you know, anybody who talks about immigration or multiculturalism on the defensive now. Oh, you have blood in your hands. You're responsible for this. We saw even a version of that with Chelsea Clinton. I think a lot of that's just sort of cheap taking political shots. In terms of formally stirring up tension, I haven't seen as much movement activity around that. That being said, there is a school of thought that's both on the left and on the right called accelerationism, which means we're all going to hell, let's accelerate it and get to what's next. And there were notes of that mindset in the shooter's manifesto. So I think that's something for us to think about as a society.
Does that manifest itself in a desire by some of these folks to really foment a race war, that they're looking for a race based conflict?
Well, I think that to a degree, yes. I think that there are ongoing issues that are legitimate issues and grievances in the West that I think we're all grappling with. And there's a sense that the West system is cracking in some ways, right? This kind of neoliberalism combined with open immigration, what they call invade the world, invite the world, and so forth. And I think we're seeing some of the flaws in it, and the reaction has emerged in the populist right with Trump and Brexit and Orban and Salvini and Bolsonaro. And now it's starting to happen on the left as we're seeing more socialist-leaning candidates. You could put AOC in that camp and maybe Corbyn and people like that. So I think there's a natural bubbling up of issues that we're grappling with in the West and there's kind of this underlying ideological issue of open borders and multiculturalism against people who believe in sovereignty and a certain identity of their country and perceive that as being under threat. Add to that an economic and social situation where we have an increasing number of unmarried young men whose prospects have gone down from their dads, whose, you know, wages have not increased. They have more debt. Healthcare costs a lot more. And they see lots of changes demographically and so forth in the company. And I think that cohort is starting to lose faith in the system. And that's where there's real danger of those people, radicalizing and embracing an ideology that says America's sort of screwed anyway, or the West is screwed anyway. Let's just burn it all down, and then we can start from the ashes. And I think it's really dangerous when that becomes rational for people.
Stephanie Kidd has a question.
It's interesting because you're talking about basically two different levels of information that's competing out there. One is this war of ideologies, and that's, we have this multiculturalism and these battles about immigration and so on. But then you've also got it like a different level, and that is the person who is actually going out there to find a way to do actual harm to people, not just to ferment trouble, but to actually go out there and to take action. Is there any sense that there is an international standard among governments to sort of separate those two and to be able to find a way to isolate the truly dangerous, the lone wolves out there, the people that actually are going to go out on their own and do something terrible?
40 seconds.
And how do we communicate with governments on that?
40 seconds for the answer, Jeff.
Yeah, no, I think that's a terrific point, and we need to be very proactive at catching people when it converts into violence. And political violence, no matter any political perspective, is absolutely wrong. And so we really need to be aggressive in countering the violent forms of this extremism. And we also need to be careful of not over-labeling, painting with too broad a brush. That will backfire big time. We need civil discourse, really, our only way out of this.
Jeff Giza, I want to thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and opinions. Hopefully, we can have you back on this program again to continue sharing your thoughts with our audience. And also, the next time you're in Chicago, we'd love to have you around the Red Roundtable here in Chicago. Thanks very much, Jeff Giza, joining us tonight from Washington, D.C. I want to thank Mike Carbonaggi and Phil Beverly on the left side of my panel. On the right side, Stephanie Hitt and Josh Cantrell. We thank you very much for joining us on this St. Patrick's Day edition of Beyond the Beltway. Our thanks to Fritz Goldman and Sam Greenberg for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Standing up for what's right, helping out when things go wrong, seeking the truth and speaking our minds, not just making records, but breaking them. Leading the way behind the camera, beyond the runway, and on the silver screen. Not just making our mark, but making a difference. Now that's a job for a Girl Scout. Girl Scouts, preparing girls for a lifetime of leadership.
It's a bully, but we aren't afraid of a fight. It's elusive, but our focus never fades. It's deadly, but we were born to defeat cancer. You may not have heard of us, but our work has helped millions impacted by cancer. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. We are leaders in advancing breakthroughs in immunotherapy, genomics, and personalized medicine. This research saves lives. After 65 years of fighting blood cancers, we've arrived at a game-changing belief. The cures for cancer are in our blood. The drugs and treatments we've developed for blood cancers have helped people affected by many different types of cancers. We are the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Beating cancer is in our blood. Learn more at LLS.org.
Debt. We can all get in a bit too deep. Members of the NFCC, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, can help you put debt in its place.
Credit cards took charge of my financial life. An NFCC credit counselor helped me get back in control. I took charge of my debt.
Student loan debt followed me wherever I went. My NFCC financial advocate taught me all I needed to know. I mastered my student loan debt.
We wanted to buy our first home, but weren't sure if we were mortgage ready. Our NFCC housing counselor helped us make a plan. We're on a path to our first home.
NFCC member agencies serve all 50 states and Puerto Rico. Convenient, helpful, knowledgeable, nonprofit. Financial advocates there for you.
We put debt in its place.
Be one of 5 million people to beat debt by 2020. Connect with an NFCC certified credit counselor at your local member agency today. Go to nfcc.org/stopdebt or call 877-410-6322.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv.